and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, and I got you a Diet Coke. And the program is brought to you by the unextinguishable log from Taylor Fuels. You're an Osawapaha brave, surveying the white man's cavalry as it marches across the endless expanse of plains your people have inhabited for millennia. It is here on the prairie that you grew up hunting bison and short grass manatee. You know this land better than anyone. You know for a fact that there is no fabled city of gold or fountain of youth. There's grass, and lots of it. But the Spaniards don't believe you, and they just keep coming. Unless you are able to ally with your ancestral nemesis, the Pococasi. You've fought each other for 10,000 years, but at least they don't wander around with pots on their heads like a bunch of lunatics, or have overpriced meals called tapas, which are just appetizers, but are charged like entrees so that you're not even full by the end, but somehow you've spent your whole week's food budget on a plate of biscuit with shrimp on them. No, the Pococasi are many things, but they do not swindle men on overpriced meal samples. Also, the Pococasi show up to things on time. Maybe they'll be late by 10 minutes, but they're not going to rock up 3 hours late and shrug and say they were out late salsa dancing and lighten up and have a tapas. No, sir. And that's why, when you give the signal, you will ally with the Pococasi. And they will come charging into the canyon to slaughter the Spaniards as you block the exit. All you have to do is send the signal. The smoke signal. You motion to a fellow Osawapaha brave, Green Horse, and he lights a fire. Black dots soar into the air, turning the sky itself into a palette with which to paint your war plans. Spanish approach. We take rear. You attack. Uh-oh, says Green Horse. What? The fire went out. You look up, and to your horror, a crucial plume of smoke has been left off of the last words of your smoke signal. It should say, you attack the Spanish. But without the needed smoke plume, you've spelled out Belgium by mistake. Across the canyon, you see smoke signals rise and return. It's the Pococasi. Attack Belgium? No, you shout. Start another fire. We need to tell them to attack the Spanish. Colonel Flamenco is right there. Tell them to attack. We can't, says Green Horse. Our non-name brand firewood just won't stay lit. Across the canyon, more smoke signals are rising. Thought attack Spaniards. You say Belgium. Send smoke signal otherwise? If no smoke signal, okay, we attack Belgium. You jump up and down and wave your arms, then point frantically down at the canyon where the Spaniards are building a tapas bar. Uh-oh, says Green Horse. Looks like the Pococasi are building wooden ships. And now they're boarding the wooden ships and sailing east. Not sure where exactly, but based on the general trajectory and position of the moon, I'd say probably Belgium. Looks like you should have used an unextinguishable fire log when you had the chance. Unextinguishable fire logs from Taylor Fuels never go out at inopportune moments, or even at all. Bury them, toss them in a lake, lock them in a vault. Nothing save time is ever going to extinguish one of those demonic stumps. The unextinguishable fire log from Taylor Fuels. We didn't start the fire, but we sure as hell can't put it out. Now, before I bring on today's guest, it's a time for another installment of Mea Culpa, where I apologize for something bad I did in order to try and get ahead of a vicious media cycle. So yesterday, on the program, I brought on Justin Robert Young. We talked about the Mueller report, which found no evidence that Donald Trump had colluded with the Russians to win the 2016 election. Now, you may or may not know that for the last 2 years, I have been also conducting my own federal probe on whether or not Mike Pence colluded with the Amish. Now, let me first say how proud I am of all that the Heaton probe accomplished. With 15 full-time attorneys, 2 undercover Mennonites, a mascot, and a budget of $16 million, we conducted the most extensive investigation in vice presidential history, second only to the time Spiro Agnew strangled a Denny's waitress. Over the course of our probe, we subpoenaed 350 butter churners in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, by fax, and then later, after the advice of counsel, by mail. Now let me stress, this was no witch hunt. We had a specific, narrow remit. Did the Amish hack the DNC server back in 2016? And did Mike Pence knowingly accept that data from them in order to tip the scales of the election? Now, unfortunately, about 8 months into the probe, I completely lost interest and then just plumb forgot about the whole thing. At some point, any emails with probe updates or Mike Pence in the subject line got automatically moved to my spam filter, which our IT guy, Timmy, failed to pick up on. In my mind, that makes Timmy the real villain in all of this, and for that reason, I have recommended to Attorney General William Barr that Timmy be given the death penalty. Whatever the case, I had done virtually no work whatsoever on our Mike Pence Amish probe by the time my colleague Robert Mueller filed his report on Russian collusion. So 2 nights ago, I drank 7 Red Bulls and pulled an all-nighter. But around 5 a.m., I threw in the towel, and in a decision which brings shame to my family, I simply copy and pasted the Warren Commission's report about JFK's assassination, changing the words Kennedy to Moscow and the word shot to colluded with. Then, after turning in my report to the Attorney General, I tried to extort Michael Avenatti for $20 million. I regret my actions, and I would like to apologize to Mike Pence and his family for insinuating that he is Amish. I'd also like to apologize to Lee Harvey Oswald, who did not collude with the Russians from a book depository, at least this time, despite the contents of my report. Thank you. My guest today is Mike May. He is the Vice President of Business Strategy at Huge out of Washington, D.C., and thrilled to have him on. Mike, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Heaton. How you doing?
I'm very well. So I had a few friends that had gone to a presentation you'd done at South by Southwest that dealt with tribalism and branding. And I thought that's such an interesting way to approach things, because a lot of the time, particularly those of us in the media landscape and the political media landscape, we tend to focus on tribalism in terms of ideology and in terms of the political ramifications of it. But you're approaching it from a business perspective and a branding perspective. And so I wanted to talk to you about what you've been working on and what you found.
So I also think it's important to take a look at it from the political perspective, just to give you a little bit of background for how this came to be. I've been working in advertising and branding and marketing for a couple of decades. Okay. And for most of that time, I've lived in Washington, D.C. So I exist literally at the intersection of brands and politics, you know, for the last over a decade.
You've got multiple types of happy hours you can go to.
Exactly. Something's always open.
Yeah.
So when you live inside the Beltway, it's hard not to be hypersensitive to what's happening in politics. And when you're in my industry, it's hard not to be just as sensitive about what's happening with brands and advertising and marketing. And over the last couple of years, I've seen brands increasingly tap into tribalistic sentiments. So Patagonia is a very good example, in that their whole ethos is around conservationism and environmentalism. I wouldn't even call them an apparel company, by the way. I would classify Patagonia as an idea on environmental stewardship currently doing business in the outdoor apparel industry.
Okay.
And so at the end of 2017, when they filed a lawsuit against the federal government for its initiative to privatize some national monuments, we paid attention to how the public, particularly on social media, was responding to that initiative and what kind of marketing and brand lift Patagonia received as a result of that. Not long after that, we saw a bunch of other initiatives. We saw Nike. We saw Dick's Sporting Goods pulling AR-15s out of their stores. Mm-hmm. We saw Levi's taking a stand against gun control as well, and a number of others as well. And so it started to one of the things we see in marketing is a trend is identified, the risk is assessed, and then other marketers will start to explore it. The analog I use is, you know, back around 1999, dozens, hundreds of brands were rushing to figure out their digital strategy. Well, today, brands are trying to figure out, what's my value-based strategy? What's my point of view on controversial topics? Because I may get the chance, like Dick's Sporting Goods or Nike or Gillette to take a stand of my own accord, or like Starbucks or the NFL, I may be forced to take a stand when I'm not quite ready to because somebody is using my brand as a platform for something.
Okay. Out of curiosity, the cynic in me thinks that, you know, having a particular tribal viewpoint or really promoting it could be a marketing tool rather than something that's socially conscious. What do you see as the division between a company going, hey, I bet we can get millennials to buy our stuff if we slap some code words on it, versus we really want to affect change in a positive way. Let's, you know, unify our marketing strategy as well.
I think you're seeing examples of both right now.
Okay.
Right? There are some initiatives that appear to be coming straight from the CEO. Dick's Sporting Goods and Levi's come to mind, where and Tom's Shoes, where the CEO is personally motivated by something, and they're also in a position in their lives and their careers where they assume a mantle of moral responsibility. There's a quote by the CEO of Levi's when he's talking about how his company has to do something about social issues because he feels like, because he's in a position of power and has an opportunity to do something, there's almost a noblesse oblige element to it where there's a responsibility of people in senior positions to do that. There are other examples where it's an initiative that feels like it's coming out of the marketing department, and it's less around the cultural identity or driven by the cause and more stunty. But what I think is interesting about both of them is they're giving the entire population of brands and marketers some evidence to look at and say, so what's going to happen if I do something like this?
Does it tend to be, is it just the lingo that's used in terms of, like, you know, Gillette did a very famous commercial here about a month and a half ago where it was, you know, kind of sort of anti-toxic masculinity, pro 21st century viewpoints on gender relations. Does it tend to be focused on the vocabulary to transmit these ideas, or are there accompanying actions that go with them? By which I mean, like, from my vantage point, I would rather see companies promote social change in whatever realm they're doing it by, you know, being active in a charity sector or treating their employees better or attempting to have a more ethical line of products. I'm less concerned with them just adopting a particular viewpoint for advertising purposes. Do they tend to do both? Like, where does the energy?
Yeah, so you typically see a brand that takes an initiative like this follow it up with some sort of action. To be honest, most of the actions are kind of anemic compared to the size and scale of the brand at stake. Mm-hmm. You know, a $2 million donation by a company the size of Gillette is not really moving the needle on a social issue. But the reason I think I'm optimistic about brands' involvement in this space is that independent of $2 million or $5 million that they donate, brands are powerful influencers. I mean, you couldn't miss all of the attention that Gillette got for taking a stand on this issue. You couldn't miss all of the attention that Nike got and Dick's Sporting Goods got. And because of their reach and their influence, I think they have the opportunity to elevate some of these topics into the social consciousness that put a little wind at the backs of these issues and can start to build some of that momentum. It's always better if they couple it with actions, and some brands have done that as well. I think that's one of the changes that we're going to see is that, you know, you talk to consumers and they can see through the marketing, right? They can tell when a company is just trying to co-opt a cause.
Be an individual and really embrace your individuality. That's why you should buy Pepsi. Look, we've got Kendall Jenner. She's walking on a street holding a Pepsi. You love them, don't you, millennials?
Yeah, exactly.
I hope people are more savvy on that kind of thing.
Well, and she hasn't quite solved the police brutality problem yet, but Pepsi is still working on it.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is that consumers they're not falling for it, and they're increasingly demanding that brands put their money where their mouth is. So far, we've seen people get excited to see big brands as allies of theirs and social causes that are important to them. The next thing that we're going to see is customers increasingly challenging brands to actually make a difference and brands responding.
Ah, good. See, that's the thing I would like, because I am not a fan of tribalism. And I, in talking to you, I get the impression from you that you're a little bit more balanced than me, where I think you've got, you see a positive, efficacious nature to brands in embracing tribalism, And what I'm worried about is I'm worried about companies rather than really promoting some type of positive change, like, you know, whether it's adopting better environmental practices or alternately giving their employees more vacation time, both good things, right? What I'm worried about is companies just staking out their battle lines in a culture war to where the energy is just hating the other team and liking whatever our team is in this particular vantage point, but not actually accomplishing anything other than that fire. So pitch me on why I should be less cynical at these marketing attempts.
Well, the opportunity that exists for brands to create social change is a result of tribalism. One of the things that we saw in our research is that when brands took a stand on an issue where there wasn't really a lot of opposition, they wouldn't get nearly the marketing lift. They wouldn't get as much pickup of social conversation. They wouldn't get as many media mentions. Their search reputation wouldn't increase. But as they chose issues that were increasingly contentious, they would explode in conversation, and all of that would lead to greater cultural relevance and awareness of the brand and give it more of an opportunity to impact a cause. So it's a bit of a catch-22, right? Because the reason some of these initiatives take fire is because you've got a strong champion and a strong opponent.
Okay.
You know, think about, so one of the metaphors we use is this idea of politics as a spectator sport. And I think that's increasingly what's happening, right? We've got our team and the other team is the villain, and we want our team to win, and we're paying attention to the plays they're running and the players they're drafting and the statistics. But we also want the other team to lose just as much as we want our team to win. And so when you see a brand take a stand on a social issue, let's say gun control, for example, you've got a lot of people rushing in to attack that brand's initiative, and just as many people rushing in to defend that brand. And that's where all of that conversation comes from. And that's what makes this a cultural phenomenon. It's a result of this tribalism. We track some other initiatives that weren't nearly as contentious, and they just don't register because, you know, it's like watching the first place team in the league beat up the squad that's in 14th in a danger of relegation.
That saddens me, because it's like if you know, the McDonald's goes, hey, we're gonna spend, you know, $15 million digging wells in Ghana to help people climb out of misery and have better lives. People are like, meh, don't care. But if McDonald's is like, hey, you know, we're gonna absolutely adopt this position on the culture war on the color of Band-Aids. If Band-Aids should not be called nude, they should be called, you know, and then all of a sudden they get a huge lift. Oh, I'm not. That saddens me.
Exactly. Well, and you said McDonald's. Burger King was one of the brands that we looked at where they did a number of videos around education and awareness, one on net neutrality and one on the pink tax. And they were these funny, quirky punking of their customers, educational initiatives, but they didn't resonate in part because there's no real opposition to what they were standing for. So yeah, digging wells in Ghana, there's not a population of 5 million diehards who are insisting that there absolutely should not be water for people in Ghana.
See, and that's fascinating. So you're saying a big part of the lift and the boost you get from these tribal signals, there has to be somebody that does. If it's just like, hey, we all agree this thing's a good thing, so we're doing it, you don't get media attention for that. You have to have somebody dislike you that you could fight?
I think that's part of it, unfortunately. And it's good for brands in that it gives them all of the noise that happens as a result of taking a stand on contentious issues. It doesn't damage the brand. So all of the brands that we've taken a look at, we've seen no evidence that a brand has had to recant its position. Nobody has said, I'm sorry for taking the stand. Nobody has gone into damage control. Nobody has recanted its position. And so in fact, we have evidence to the contrary that a lot of the mechanics of good marketing are actually improving as a result of this boost in cultural relevance for the brand by taking a stand on a social issue. So if you think about these companies not as brands that we tend to anthropomorphize, but as actual people making these decisions, and as people like us, they are motivated to try to make a difference in some way with the tools they have at their disposal. seeing that their brand isn't damaged as a result of all of this conversation, they can actually make the business case. We're stronger as a result from taking the, as a result of taking this position. It gives them the air cover they need to justify to their boards, to shareholders, that this is a good business strategy as well as a good social strategy. Is it mercenary? I think there's an element that has to be, right? When you're a public company or you have a large number of shareholders, you can't be irresponsible with the actions you're taking. But if it does give them the air cover they need to make a difference in a social issue, I'm really curious to see how that plays out over the next couple of years.
I am as well. I'm kind of, I do not like tribalism or the culture war. And so for that reason, I get like say, for example, with the NFL going into people kneeling during the pledge, I have a fairly low I have a fairly high threshold on that, which irritates me in terms of what I find unpalatable and blasphemous. So if somebody wants to kneel during the pledge, it does not bother me. I'm unaffected by that. I also don't watch football. So I just, that whole thing didn't bother me. But it did bother me that yet another realm that had hitherto been a kind of neutral cultural position that people could go to regardless of their politics became thrust into this, you know, glorious Manichaean conflict between red team and blue team. And I lamented that because that meant that there was going to be less good discourse and less comedy, between people. So I feel like I'm looking at the writing on the wall going like, all right, at some point we're going to have like only Republican soda and Democrat soda. And then there'll be, I guess I'll drink water. I'm not really sure what will happen to those of us that aren't part of either team. Out of curiosity, when these happen, you said that it hasn't damaged brands when they take a position on a contentious issue. Does it have a winnowing effect on the customers that use them? I mean, we frequently say people vote with dollars. Do people wind up doing that, or is that just something we like to talk to ourselves about, a la Chick-fil-A or Dick's Sporting Goods with guns or whatever it is?
We did take a look at e-commerce purchases as a result of this as well to see if there's an immediate bump. And there is some evidence of what I call gratitude commerce, where people like what a brand has done and is going to reward it, you know, by buying a pair of Nikes or subscribing to Gillette's razor subscription or something like that. So you see a small bump. The other part of our methodology is that we also took a look at what happened after the initiative to see if the brands were operating at a new higher level, if their e-commerce had sort of business as usual was higher than it was before, if their share of voice and social conversation was higher than it was. And in most cases, we saw a bit of a bump there as well. But I think the other reason the tribalism component is important here is because brands know if you do something controversial, your customers are going to be the first ones to hear about it. And if the only people you reach are your existing customers, there's nothing to be gained. You can only lose customers. You can't win the customers you already have. So here's the problem again, right? The louder these initiatives tend to be based on their controversy, the more likely a brand is to replace its backlash lost customers with new customers from a groundswell.
Ah, okay. So there might be some shuffling, but it winds up being a net boost for them.
That's the evidence we've seen so far, yeah.
So I was doing some research on this, and I went through some of the notes that you sent me in preparation for this. One of the things that I was surprised by was you had ranked, and I don't know what the polling was, but you'd ranked institutions in the United States according to public trust. And I wasn't surprised to see that the military was at number one. It usually is. Americans tend to have a consistent high regard for the military. And I wasn't surprised to see that the federal government had dropped down, both for obvious reasons and for just the general interpretation of the country. But I was surprised that second and third place were Amazon and Google in terms of public trust, because I tend to think that we tend to be kind of skeptical of big corporations, but apparently we're either impressed or at least appreciate the efficacious nature of these big companies.
Yeah, and I think when I saw that data, I had the same reaction. That can't possibly be true. But then I had to check myself and remember that Twitter is not the real world. And so it's very easy if you have. Look, we live in an algorithmic era. It's very easy if you have a point of view and you're on social media to find yourself surrounded with your point of view, whether you try to or not. So we all live in bubbles, and I love seeing data like this, which challenges my preconceptions. I think the reason that consumers do have more faith and trust in big business compared to, you know, compared to the federal government is the evidence that they actually can get things done.
I think when we're on, like, you know, budget attempt number 43 or whatever it is of the last, you know, 20 years. Meanwhile, Amazon's able to get a book to my house within about 16 minutes.
Exactly. Right. We've got robots and drones flying around in the private sector, and the public sector has massive government shutdowns on a regular basis.
So then from my perspective, I'm coming back around here. You're perking my mood up, Mike. If I am anti-tribal, but I also really like free enterprise, then we're at least moving in a direction where people are putting more, they're more trusting of commercial enterprises in general as we move through this kind of proxy fight between blue team and red team.
Well, I don't know that we're out of the woods.
Okay.
Because I will admit the data that we found suggests that tribalism is good for brands that want to take a stand. But there's nothing yet to suggest that it's good for the country.
Yeah.
The system works as long as the tribalism is in place. And, you know, we haven't looked out far enough to develop some hypotheses on what happens in the next few years if more and more brands begin to do this. How does that change the landscape? But that's the next phase of the work we're looking at.
I will be very curious to talk to you about that because I have a fairly dim view of it. I think social capital is increasingly important to me, particularly during the Trump years. He's not been very helpful in that capacity, and I again not being a fan of either tribalism or the culture war. When I look at tribalism as becoming a key marketing phenomenon, I see that perhaps increasing the bottom line of the company, but at the same time, further dividing people in the United States that otherwise don't need to be divided. And so I'm kind of that seems to me that that's going to probably have a bad societal effect overall and that it'll weaken us up until we have a war. And then we'll all get back onto yay America.
Well, it's true. I guess the good news is that the reason we're seeing brands move into this space is that they're going where their customers are, right? Their customers are choosing sides. So this is no different than putting a Chevy logo on a Manchester United jersey in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Right? You've got fans and you want to be in front of their fans at a marketing level. Now, there's things happening at the CEO level where they actually want to create change for their employees and for their communities. And that, I think, is the more promising. But there's another piece of data that we found that I think is potentially optimistic. Consumers believe not only that brands have a better chance of creating social change and solving society's social ills than the federal government, they're actually seeking out brands to make that change more than they are the government.
Okay, so, I like that. All right, good.
So, You know, you talked about voting with your wallets, right? We can affect change at the policy level every 2 years. We can affect change with brands every single day. And if consumers really are tied into what their customers are looking for, one of the things our customers have said is they want brands to help bring the country back together. So it's not just you. There are other people out there who are trying to mend the rift as well.
Okay.
And I think if brands are tied into that, we may see some efforts in that direction.
I'm digging this. So Pepsi will become the Democratic soda. Coke will become the Republican soda. But then Mr. Pibb will swing in on Team Unity. And that'll be the one I'm guzzling. Diet Mr. Pibb. All right. No, I like that. I like that there's kind of a volunteerist component to this where, you know, rather than having a one-size-fits-all solution mandated from a government, that there could be a way to navigate what we're doing right now on an individual level and on a societal level where no one's being compelled to do something by force, but rather buying into it through commerce and social push, which I would definitely prefer.
Right. The other thing that we saw is that Americans increasingly believe that the government is controlled by special interests.
Mm-hmm.
They're not wrong, but what if the special interests that are having increasing influence on the government are the brands that the consumers themselves are voting for on a daily basis? How does that change things? And that, you know, that's what we're looking at in the future, potentially, to see if that starts to evolve.
Okay. Well, a final question for you. This is a quick kicker. I'm like a fifth year millennial. I'm 35, so I'm like right at the vanguard of millennials. I believe I am no longer relevant. That's how old I am. But there's millennials, which has been a lot of marketing focus the last few years in terms of research. There's Gen X, there's baby boomers. How do and then iGen now, I guess, coming up, that's the one that's kind of post-college. How do we react to, say, tribalism and branding and social consciousness? Are we all more or less on the same page? Does one group favor it more than the other?
I haven't seen any data that makes a compelling case that generationally people respond to tribalism a little differently. Okay. I've seen a lot of data that suggests that younger people have more open minds, maybe because patterns haven't been grooved in the same way, and they've grown up a little more around tribalism instead of picking a team early on. You know, so I've got a lot of friends who are watching English soccer, and you have to choose your team, and sometimes it takes 3 or 5 years to figure out who you want to root for, as opposed to if you were born in Manchester, England, you've got one or two choices, right? And so you fall in pretty quickly. So maybe with the younger population, they're taking a wait and see, and that might mean they're happy as neutrals for a longer period of time.
Okay. Well, Mike, you've given me food. You've given me mental food to think about, that there might be some positive things coming out of all the tribalism that I see rampant, that there might be some good volunteerist impulses at work. So I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Little bit of listener feedback before we finish up today. On iTunes, Fatman314 says, 10 out of 10, I absolutely despise this podcast, but I can't find the downvote button. I hope he moves to YouTube soon, where my downvoting thumbs are keenly poised. 5 stars. That is a very mixed review right there. I feel like that's like an angry date that keeps wanting to go on a date with me, which I'll take. But I appreciate the 5 stars. Thank you. And I probably have this in the jargon to follow, but if you want to see me, I am on Facebook Watch. In fact, I'll mention that in a moment. But first, can I ask you, dear listener, not Fatman 314 or whatever it was, but you listening right now, may I ask, have you subscribed to this podcast yet? Of course you haven't. You haven't. Well, you know what? I don't need you. I'm doing just fine without your podcast subscription. You're at home, laying in bed, looking up at the ceiling, thinking, I wonder what something's off with Andrew Heaton's up to. And you know what we're up to? We're out dancing. That's what we're up to. We're not thinking of you at all. We're out dancing with other podcasts and subscribers, and you had your chance, and you didn't put a ring on it, and so you can go to hell. I'm sorry. I shouldn't. I'm sorry. I'm just getting very emotional. I didn't want to yell at you, listener. If you do come to your senses, however, and subscribe to this podcast, maybe check it out on Facebook Watch, because then you can gaze upon my handsome mug. And remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton, or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays, except last Friday because I got busy. But I promise very soon I will have a new awesome newsletter for you. Finally, please subscribe. I don't know if I mentioned that, but do that. Rate and review the podcast like our friend did a couple of minutes ago. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage and figure out what type of soda we should drink. Thank you and good day.